From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, writer Joyce Johnson talks about her relationship with Jack Kerouac. They met in 1957 through their mutual friend Allen Ginsberg when Kerouac was broke and not yet famous. The two became lovers and were together when On the Road was published, and he suddenly found himself hailed as the king of the Beats. Johnson's new book, Door Wide Open, collects the letters she and Kerouac wrote to each other during their two-year relationship. She'll read some of those letters. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the newly reissued complete Blue Note sessions of jazz pianist Horace Parlan. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. The White House said today no agreement had been reached yet at the Camp David Middle East Peace Summit, but President Clinton is still working hard for an accord. NPR's Ted Clark is at the Camp David Summit, where the talks are in their ninth day.
The negotiations are continuing. They're described as very intensive, very difficult. Joe Lockhart, the White House spokesman, said, "We are at a pivotal moment." And he said, "President Clinton wants to make sure that every possible avenue has been explored before he makes the judgment that there is no way to get an agreement." So this seems to be a last-ditch effort to get some kind of agreement before President Clinton heads off to Japan.
NPR's Ted Clark in Thurmont, Maryland. The heat wave in the South continues to take its toll. The weekend deaths of two elderly men in New Orleans are now officially blamed on the heat, bringing the total to 7 deaths in Louisiana and 12 in Texas. Arizona, New Mexico, Arkansas, Oklahoma, and Kansas are also sweltering with no relief in sight. As the South bakes in triple-digit temperatures, people farther north are experiencing the other extreme. Temperatures overnight in northern Minnesota fell as low as 29 degrees. Not many readings that low have ever been recorded in Minnesota in July. The temperatures in the Minneapolis area yesterday never got past 60 degrees. Flags are at half-staff in Georgia in memory of Senator Paul Coverdell, who died yesterday. While lawmakers' supporters are mourning the loss, the talk is now beginning about who will take Coverdell's Senate seat. From member station WABE in Atlanta, Joshua Leves reports.
Since the news broke of Senator Coverdell's death, responses have been pouring in. His friends and fellow lawmakers are remembering Coverdell as a great and principled leader who never strayed from his commitment to public service. Even his political rivals, including President Clinton and Georgia's Democratic Governor Roy Barnes, have issued statements calling Coverdell an exemplary man who will be sorely missed. Under Georgia law, Governor Barnes will appoint a replacement until a special election is held, and he's expected to appoint a Democrat to fill the seat. Among those reportedly being considered are entrepreneur Michael Coles, who ran against Coverdell in the last election, and State Attorney General Thurbert Baker. The governor has said it's too soon to discuss a replacement publicly. A memorial service for Coverdell will be held in Atlanta on Saturday. Joshua Leves, NPR News, Atlanta.
Officials in the state of Texas announced today a rare multiple execution next month by putting to death two convicted murderers on the same night. Texas leads the United States in the number of capital punishment cases. Barring intervention by the courts of Texas Governor George W. Bush, Brian Roberson and Oliver Cruz will die by lethal injection in separate executions on August 9th. On Wall Street, stock prices were generally lower. The Dow was down almost 44 points, the Nasdaq off 121. You're listening to NPR News. The United States plans to provide $1 billion a year in loans to help 24 sub-Saharan African nations buy AIDS drugs, medical equipment, and health services from American businesses. 70% of the world's 34 million people infected with HIV live in that area. The loans will be provided through the U.S. Export-Import Bank. The Kennedy Center officially announced the name of its new president today. It's Michael M. Kaiser, currently executive director of the Royal Opera House in London. Kim Kokich reports.
An American, Kaiser first made his mark in the corporate world as a management consultant. He went on to rescue several troubled arts organizations, including the Alvin Ailey Dance Theater and American Ballet Theater. Kaiser pledged to continue programs created by his predecessor, Lawrence Wilker, build the center's international reputation, and improve its artistic and financial resources.
This is my own little personality quirk. I like to fundraise because I believe in the product so much. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to work with a great deal of energy in the coming months and years to find the resources so that we can expand the amount of dance and theater and all range of programming here.
Michael Kaiser will become the new president of the Kennedy Center in February 2001 after finishing his tenure as executive director of the Royal Opera House in London. For NPR News, I'm Kim Kokich in Washington.
Barbra Streisand is getting ready to say goodbye to her fans, and more than once. She's planning 4 farewell concerts later this year to mark the end of her live singing career. 2 of the shows will be in Los Angeles, the others in New York a week later. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average finished 43 points lower, and the Nasdaq Composite Index was off 121 points. I'm Frank Stachow, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Writer Joyce Johnson met Jack Kerouac in 1957 through their mutual friend Allen Ginsberg. Johnson and Kerouac were lovers for nearly 2 years. Kerouac was 35 years old and not yet famous when they met. But while they were together, his novel On the Road was published, and he was transformed into the spokesperson of the Beats. Much of the time that Johnson and Kerouac were lovers, he was traveling or living in another city while she stayed in Manhattan. During those times, they communicated through letters. The letters they wrote to each other are published in the new book, Door Wide Open. Johnson is also the author of an earlier memoir called Minor Characters, focusing on the period when she knew Kerouac. But she couldn't quote from his letters in that book because Kerouac's widow withheld permission, and it wasn't until 1998 that his estate sent her copies of the letters she had written to him. I asked Joyce Johnson who she was when she met Kerouac.
Okay, I was 21 years old. I was a couple of years out of Barnard College. I was working for a literary agency, MCA, literary agency, and I was also working on my first novel. And that's what I was doing.
And what about Kerouac?
And Kerouac, I met him in January of 1957. And that was 9 months before the publication of On the Road. He'd had one previous book published, The Town and the City, but that had been published in 1951. And he'd had nothing published in between, even though he'd written a great many books. He was totally broke, worn out, discouraged. It wasn't even clear until January that Viking was indeed going to publish On the Road in the fall. They'd been holding the manuscript for several years, very nervous about putting it out because it was so bound to be so controversial.
So you weren't attracted by his celebrity because he wasn't famous yet. What did you find really attractive and interesting about him?
He was the most unusual person I'd ever met. He had an incredible memory. He told great stories. He'd had amazing adventures. And he had a kind of sweetness and melancholy about him that were also very, very appealing. And an ability to take a lot of pleasure in small, everyday things. You know, if I made him a bowl of Lipton's pea soup, I was a great cook. He totally charmed me when I met him.
Now, you met him through Allen Ginsberg, and shortly after you met, he was off on his travels again. And
yeah.
One of the early letters in your book is when he sent you from Tangiers, and I'd like you to read an excerpt of it.
Sure. This was in early March 1957. He wrote it just as he was nearing the coast of Africa. He'd been on a freighter called the SS Slovenia for about a month. All during the trip, I ate alone at a huge white tablecloth with one mysterious Yugoslavian woman, Matahari. We had a dangerous storm 500 miles out and almost foundered. In all my years as a seaman, I never saw my ship bury its nose in mountain waves and plunge up into other valleys like a rowboat. It was awful. We had to flee south and lose a day. During this ordeal, I heard the words, "Everything is God. Nothing ever happened except God." And I believed and still do. Kierkegaard and the storm together made me see this luminous, peaceful truth.
Now, I found your response to his letter so interesting because here he is, you know, traveling around the world, having these like grand adventures. and you're, you know, working in New York and trying to deal with, like, your life versus his life and how different they seemed. Read us an excerpt of your response to him.
Okay. I've thought a lot about your letter, about your finding God in the middle of the storm. I can't really comprehend that. I want you to know that about me. I scramble from day to day, hour to hour, and I seldom stop to ask questions. Because when I do, I find everything in the world senseless, without reason, and it terrifies me. I'm not defending myself. I'm simply telling you this. I look at your way with wonder, but there's nothing I can say to you about it except that. And in the meanwhile, I move 2 miles downtown to a new job, not too different from the old one, and you move across the ocean to another continent.
In a way, while he's having this big adventure, you know, going to Northern Africa, your adventure is in part being with him, knowing him.
Absolutely. That was a big adventure for me. But also my adventure, as it turned out, was also being in New York in that whole wonderful period and discovering all these very, very gifted people who are all converging on downtown Manhattan, painters, poets, photographers, actors. It was sort of an amazing scene. It was a very, very good time to be in New York.
You know, although Kerouac sounds really excited and invigorated in the first letter he sends you, his letters start to sound more depressed not long after that. Let me ask you to read an excerpt of this March 1957 letter.
There are many dull expatriate characters here I try to avoid, mostly. Not too many good vibrations in Tangier. And the Arabs, very quiet, send out no vibrations at all. So I spend most of my time musing in my room. Somehow can't write here, but anyway, that can wait. What I'm actually doing is thinking nostalgic thoughts of Frisco. Not too interested in this old world scene, as though I'd seen it before plenty. Anyway, in early April, I'm off by myself to Paris. The others can join me later to get cheap garret, then London, Dublin, Brittany. Then I try to get job on freighter, work my way back this summer. I just don't seem interested. Got too much to do in America. Shouldn't have come at all, of course. So I'll likely be seeing you in New York, in July, maybe. Look forward to seeing you. Lonely here. Don't like whores anyway, and no girls speak English. Mostly fags abound in this sinister international hive of queens. I've had everything in the books, smoked opium, ate hashish. Don't want any of it. Just musing in my room. Lights out, face sea, moon, liquid lights of anchored ships and bay. Good enough.
How did it make you feel to have him complaining about the whores?
Well, it certainly made me feel weird. It was as though he'd forgotten that I was his girlfriend. You know, and it sounded as though he was writing to one of his buddies. I didn't know what to make of it.
Were you surprised that he was in this place that he'd worked so hard to get to, and he didn't like being there, and he was saying maybe he shouldn't have come at all, and he was telling you all these other places he's going to go to, and sounding very depressed?
Well, I was surprised, because he had really been looking forward to this trip immensely and planned to spend many months in Tangier and then spend a good part of the next year traveling in Europe. But I soon learned that this was sort of a pattern of Jack's. You know, he would before he went to a place, he would fantasize about it and think that it was going to be wonderful and the solution to all his problems, and then he'd get there and inevitably the bad vibrations would set in, because wherever he went, he took his troubles with him. And I think by that time in his life, there was no place in the world where he could really be happy or comfortable. Nothing worked for him.
In the letters, he always seems to be want to be in the place that he wasn't.
That's right, to see something new and strange.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering how that affected you. For instance, I mean, he'd invite you to come and be with him in San Francisco, and then he'd write and tell you he was leaving for Mexico. He'd invite you to Mexico, and then he'd decide, no, he had to go to New York. And so you were always having to change your plans.
Well, it certainly complicated my life immensely, and it was very disappointing, because I wanted so much to travel myself. And I also, you know, had to take steps in order to prepare myself to travel, such as giving up my job or saving money or giving up my apartment. So I had a very rather complicated summer, the summer of 1957, when I was thinking first that I would join Jack in San Francisco and then later in Mexico City. I was particularly disappointed about not going to Mexico City. I began to realize that this was Jack. This was the way he was. That he, it was almost impossible for him to make a plan and stick to it.
So you never met up with him in San Francisco or Mexico, but in the in the spring of 57, he did come and stay with you in New York for a few days. And I'm going to ask you to read a letter that you wrote to him a couple of months after that. This is July of 1957. Set up this letter and then read us an excerpt.
This letter was written to Jack after he had left San Francisco, gone to Orlando, Florida with his mother, and then was preparing to go to Mexico City and inviting me. He invited me to meet him in Mexico City. I remember walking with you at night through the Brooklyn docks and seeing the white steam rising from the ships against the black sky and how beautiful it was. And I'd never seen it before, imagine. But if I'd walked through it with anyone else, I wouldn't have seen it either, because I wouldn't have felt safe in what my mother would categorically call a bad neighborhood. I would have been thinking, where's the subway, and missed everything. But with you, I felt as though nothing could touch me, and if anything happened, the hell with it. You don't know what narrow lives girls have, how few real adventures there are for them. Misadventures, yes, like abortions and little men following them in subways, but seldom anything like seeing ships at night. So that's why we've all taken off like this, and that's also part of why I love you. Take care.
Did Jack Kerouac understand your thoughts about how few adventures girls could have? I mean, did he comprehend the difference in gender?
He did. And one thing that was very important to me about our relationship was that he was very encouraging to me about my writing. And he often told me that in order to be a really important writer, I would have to really expand my experience. And he would counsel me to give up my job and take to the road like he did, which, of course, was impossible for me to do. The idea that I was going to go to Mexico City to meet him, for example, was supposed to be a kind of educational experience for me. That's how he referred to it. So he did have some notion of it, but I think he also didn't understand that a young girl like me couldn't just take to the road by herself. That sort of eluded him.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was in Mexico hoping that you'd come visit him there, and I'm going to ask you to read a letter about that. And this is shortly after a big earthquake in Mexico. Was he directly affected by the earthquake?
Yes. He was there when it happened, although the hotel where he was staying wasn't harmed, but he was terrified by it. It was a huge earthquake that really devastated Mexico City.
And this is late July of 1957. This is an excerpt from a letter by Jack Kerouac to my guest Joyce Johnson.
At first, I thought I wanted to be alone and stare at the walls, but now I realize after the earthquake, no one can be alone. Even one's own body is not alone. It is a vast aggregate of smaller living units. It is a phantom universe in itself. And maybe I've come to realize this now, because in this altitude, 8,000 feet, I don't get drunk and I'm not taking drugs anymore. My connections are dead. And I just stare healthily at the interesting world. Come on, we'll be two young American writers on a famous lark that will be mentioned in our biographies. Write soon as you can this address. I'll be waiting for your answer.
You must have been happy to get that letter.
Oh, I was thrilled to get that letter, and I immediately gave up my job and bought a ticket on TWA, which I never used.
Why?
Because the next I heard from Jack, he had gotten the Asiatic flu in Mexico City, and was going back to Orlando, Florida, and from there he planned to come to New York in time for the publication of On the Road. He thought it might be kind of interesting to be around for it.
And he
had absolutely no notion of what awaited him.
Right. Well, he was around for it. In fact, he was staying with you at your apartment the day that famous review by Gilbert Milstein came out in the New York Times. Would you describe what it was like to go with him at midnight to the newsstand and pick up this review that basically made him a star overnight?
Well, it was nothing that Jack was prepared for. I mean, he couldn't he could barely sort of take it in. It compared him in his importance to F. Scott Fitzgerald. Milstein said what Fitzgerald was to the Lost Generation, Kerouac would be to the Beat Generation, and he made him the spokesman for a whole generation. He kept reading it and sort of shaking his head and saying, "Well, I think it's pretty good. What do you think?" And I say, "Yeah, it's really good." And then the next day, the phone started ringing and never stopped.
Not all the reviews were positive, like Truman
Capote. Oh, definitely.
Yeah, describe some of the bad reviews.
Well, I would say by and large, the reviews On the Road got were hostile, humiliating, and very insulting things were said about On the Road. For example, Truman Capote said, "This isn't writing, this is typing." I mean, I can't think of any American writer who endured such consistent abuse from critics and reviewers all through his career, and it was very, very devastating for him.
How did he take the bad reviews?
They made him very depressed. Of course, he had a tendency to be depressed, and the only way he seemed to be able to get himself through this period was to step up his drinking, which was already pretty heavy.
My guest is Joyce Johnson. Her new book is called Door Wide Open. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Joyce Johnson. Her new book collects the letters she and Jack Kerouac wrote to each other. When we left off, we were talking about On the Road and the rave review in the New York Times. Soon after that review in the New York Times, he left New York. And soon after he left, you wrote a letter to your friend Elise. And I'd like you to excerpt that letter.
"I dig ironing his shirts, cooking for him, etc. It's funny. It's not at all romantic anymore, but it doesn't matter. I love him. Don't mind playing mama, since that's what he seems to want me to be. I may go down to see him in Orlando. I've gotten kind of a left-handed backwards invitation. His mother seems to want me to come. There's no doubt in my mind anymore that mama is the villain in the true classic Freudian sense."
Now, when you said it's not that romantic anymore, what did you mean?
I found myself in the position of almost having to take care of Jack to kind of get him through this whole experience that he was coping with so badly. And it was a very unfamiliar role for me. I was only 21. But I thought, you know, he would get through the difficulties of this period and come out of it. But that's really not what happened.
How did you feel being in this really unconventional relationship, yet expected to do very conventional things for Kerouac, like cooking and ironing and taking him home when he got too drunk?
Well, you know, everything seemed so crazy. We were living such a strange life that it was almost a relief to iron a shirt. It was sort of quiet and familiar, you know? Everything that was sort of quiet and familiar and home-like had gotten to seem sort of exotic to me because the life we were living was so strange. Getting Kerouac home from places was a very anxious business, getting him up four flights of stairs. So I was living in a brownstone at the time on the fourth floor. That was kind of anxious and fending off various admirers, especially other women.
Right. Now, in this letter that you just read an excerpt of, you said that there's no doubt that his mother is the villain in the true classic Freudian sense.
Mm-hmm.
What did you mean by that?
It became apparent to me that Jack really had not separated from his mother. He was overly attached to his mother. He planned to settle down and live with her, which was something that was very hard for me to understand, that she had too much of a hold on him for his own good.
Was it her trying to have a hold on him, or was it him wanting to be with her?
It worked both ways. I mean, she wanted to to keep him with her, and so that any young woman who came into his life was considered the enemy, someone who had to be fended off or driven off. At the same time, she had always been a source of refuge for him during those years when he was very broke and obscure and wandering around the United States and virtually homeless. She provided a base for him, a place where he could come and crash and write another book and keep his manuscripts and his letters. So I think without his Jack's mother, we might have had fewer Kerouac novels. She was important to him in that way, in a good way. But her emotional hold on him was very crippling for Jack emotionally.
Was his personality any different when he was in her presence?
I only saw him in her presence once. This was in the summer of 1958, after Jack had bought her a house in Long Island and moved into it with her, and he really seemed cowed by her. She ruled the house. He was like a child in the house, you know, who wasn't allowed to do this and wasn't allowed to do that. And he retreated from the whole situation by drinking a lot.
Joyce Johnson's new book is called Door Wide Open. Here's a recording of Jack Kerouac on The Steve Allen Show in 1959 with Allen at the piano.
So in the last page of On the Road, I describe how the hero, Dean Moriarty's come to see me all the way from the West Coast just for a day or two. We've just been back and forth across the country several times in cars, and now our adventures are over. We're still great friends, but we have to go into later phases of our lives. So there he goes, Dean Moriarty, ragged in the moth-eaten overcoat he brought specially for the freezing temperatures of the East. Walking off alone, and last I saw him, he rounded the corner of 7th Avenue, eyes on the street ahead, and bent to it again. Gone. So, in America, when the sun goes down, and I sit on the old broken-down river pier watching the long, long skies over New Jersey and sense all that raw land that rolls in one unbelievable huge bulge over to the West Coast and all that road going and all the people dreaming in the immensity of it. In an hour, I know by now that children must be crying in the land where they let the children cry. And tonight the stars will be out. And don't you know that God is Pooh Bear? The evening star must be drooping and shedding her sparkler dims on the prairie, which is just before the coming of complete night that blesses the earth, darkens all the rivers, cups the peaks, and folds the final shore in. Nobody knows what's going to happen to anybody besides the forlorn rags of growing old. Think of Dean Moriarty, or even think of old Dean Moriarty, the father we never found. Think of Dean Moriarty. I think of Dean Moriarty.
Joyce Johnson will talk more about Jack Kerouac in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how Jack Kerouac dealt with fame after the success of On the Road. We continue our conversation with Joyce Johnson about her new book collecting the letters she and Kerouac wrote each other. And Kevin Whitehead reviews the complete Blue Note sessions of jazz pianist Horace Parlan. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Joyce Johnson. Her new book, Door Wide Open, collects the letters that she and Jack Kerouac wrote to each other in 1957 and 58 when they were lovers. He was not yet famous when they met, but as we discussed earlier, she was with him when the New York Times review of his novel On the Road was published, turning him nearly overnight into a celebrity. I asked her how fame agreed with him.
Fame did not agree with him very well at all. Part of the problem was he didn't become famous in the way that he would have liked to have become famous. I think what he really had dreamed of was having a real, you know, a literary success, which would have been much quieter, for one thing. But instead of that, he found himself the spokesperson for the Beat Generation, and this was not a role that he felt at all comfortable with. It was something Allen Ginsberg, of course, could have played to the hilt. But Jack was not very, very good at facing the public. He was basically a shy, rather naive guy about the whole business, and it was very difficult for him being on television and so on. It was frightening for him, and it made him feel that he didn't know who he was anymore.
You say that after he became famous, there was a pack of predatory women that invaded your lives. What was it like watching all of these women flirting with Jack Kerouac?
Oh, of course, I hated it, and it made me furious. It was as though I didn't exist at all. Suddenly, there was this swarm of women around him. He was such a celebrity and so attractive, and right in front of me, these women were throwing themselves at Jack. It was very unpleasant to watch.
You say that during this period, everyone wanted to, like, give him pills or buy him drinks. He already had a drinking problem. Did it get worse?
It did get much worse. I think he felt that he had to live up to an image of himself that people had, that they didn't really expect to see someone like Jack Kerouac, who was a fairly quiet guy, kind of an observer. They expected to see someone very extroverted, like the Dean Moriarty character in his novel. So the only way he could approximate that character was to get very loaded.
And did he become more like Dean Moriarty when he did become loaded?
He became much, much more extroverted and outgoing, mm-hmm. Talked more.
Now, you said that you grew up in a house without any alcohol, with the exception of Menashevitz Passover wine.
Right.
Were there things you didn't understand about his drinking?
Yeah, I really didn't understand about his drinking. I thought that, if Jack's could just sort of get through this period and settle down and maybe have a real home somewhere, he could sort of straighten himself out. And he kept wanting to stop drinking, and he would make attempts even during this period. And in order to stop drinking, he would, we'd basically take the phone off the hook and stay shut up in the house for a week. He always seemed a different person in a way when he'd stopped drinking for a while. And then his innate sweetness would come out.
Now, one of the times he came to New York, he came to do a series of readings at the Village Vanguard. At the performance you went to, he was very drunk. Would you explain what that performance was like?
Well, this was one of his last performances at the Vanguard. He'd been there for a week. He came on stage, and he had a bottle of Thunderbird in his hand. And he turned his back on the audience and sort of bopped along with the musicians as though he'd forgotten where he was. And then when he read, the words were often very slurred, and the people in the audience got very restive. They got up, and some people booed, some people left, and he was sort of aware of that. It was kind of a humiliating performance.
You wrote him a letter trying to discourage him from drinking. I'm going to ask you to read an excerpt of that letter.
I'm sorry you felt so depressed about New York once you reached home. But, baby, forgive me for being boring, but I do think it's all that drinking. Not drinking itself, but the amount of it you do. Like my cats, you don't know when to stop. It's really desperate, gluttonous drinking, like maybe the whiskey ocean's going to dry up soon, which, alas, it won't, you know. Listen, when you come to New York in October, why don't you try this? Eat a really good meal somewhere, with maybe a glass of wine or two, and then just stick to beer. It was those two bottles of wine that fouled you up. Also, to avoid feeling shabby, bring one clean shirt and pajamas next time. Horrible feeling living in same clothes for 3 days. Sorted, my dear. Oh, practical bourgeois Joyce that I am, don't let me bug you, but consider above suggestions.
Did you feel like you were being bourgeois by suggesting that he wear clean clothes and not be drunk?
Yeah, I did feel a little bourgeois. I wanted to be cool and beat, but there was a bourgeois practical side of me, which probably saved my life and sanity.
How did you and Kerouac end up breaking up?
We went out to dinner. This was in October of 1958, with a bunch of artists we knew, and right before my eyes, Jack was flirting outrageously with a woman whom I knew was very interested in him, and I could sort of see the handwriting on the wall, and I'd seen this kind of thing one too many times, and I just couldn't stand it. So I asked Jack to come outside the restaurant with me. And I told him I couldn't bear it and that it was the end. I said to him, because it was the only thing I could think of, you're nothing but a big bag of wind.
What was his reaction when you told him you couldn't take it anymore?
He said, I told you, I don't like blondes. Unrequited love's a bore. You know, it was though we were shouting nonsense at each other. And then he stomped off into the restaurant and I went up the block, and that was it.
So that was really it?
That was it. It ended very abruptly.
How did he describe you in Desolation Angels?
As middle class, sad, and looking for something.
He also wrote, perhaps the best love affair I ever had.
Right, and he said that I had me a companion there. And I think that was a very important thing to Jack, the fact that we were both writers. And a lot of the things we wrote to each other were about our writing. And this was a novelty for him to have a woman in his life who was as interested in writing as he was.
Now, when his letters were published long after his death, you were able to read what he wrote about you to his men friends. What were some of the things that surprised you about what he said about you in his letters to them?
Oh, well, he wrote, I mean, for example, he wrote to Neil Cassidy, I believe, I have a blonde novelist following me from New York. I mean, I wasn't following him. He'd invited me. And he said that there'd be orgies in San Francisco, which was a lot of nonsense.
Orgies with you?
Yeah. You know, it was sort of male boasting. And he would also write to his friends that he'd just been in bed with three women, but it was always three women. As I read the letters, I thought the same three women. you know, a lot of it was assuming a certain persona when he wrote to these guys. The thing that was most hurtful to me was a letter he wrote to Allen Ginsberg. This was around, I don't know, December 1957, and he had just been in contact with an old girlfriend of his, and he wanted to get, for the time being, he wanted to get back together with her. So he wrote to Alan that when Alan's friend Peter Orlovsky came back to New York, he could move in with me if he needed a place to stay, because Jack wanted to make it with this other woman. And that was really, I thought, ugly. And even though it was, you know, many, many years later, it still hurt when I read it.
Right. Yeah, it must have been so strange to read these things many years
later.
Very
strange. I mean, what an odd position to be in. One often doesn't know so much about the people that one has loved.
Yeah, and then you probably had to ask yourself, which were the more honest letters, the one he wrote to you or the ones he wrote to
exactly.
His men friends?
Yeah.
My guest is Joyce Johnson. Her new book is called Door Wide Open. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer Joyce Johnson. Her new book collects the letters that she and Jack Kerouac wrote to each other. You say in your new book that you've had to protect your memories from being swamped by Kerouac's legend. What are some parts of the legend that don't fit with your memories?
Well, the idea that Jack was such a free spirit, you know, mainly, that this big example of freedom, or this, you know, or that he was this great Buddhist, those things. Because, you know, although he certainly did go on the road, and you know, deep inside him, he wasn't free at all. He was so knotted up and so miserable and so attached to his mother. And Buddhism was something that was very important to Jack, and he it was one of those things he looked to find some solution to what troubled him. But he really misused it, even though he had a profound intellectual understanding of it. He used Buddhism to sort of rationalize all his problems and you know, what was the point of dealing with them since we're all going to die anyway?
Recent biographies of Kerouac have asked whether he was really bisexual. Any thoughts about that?
I never felt when I was with him that he was attracted sexually to other men. And I know other women who were also involved with Jack, and they never felt that way either. Certainly he had deep psychic connections to his male friends, but I never felt there was anything physical about those feelings that he had.
What did you think a few years ago of the Gap campaign of, you know, Kerouac wore khakis?
One thing that amused me very much about that campaign was there was a picture of Jack wearing khakis in a photo shoot. It was an old photo that had been taken for Pageant magazine. A photographer had followed Jack and me around the village for a night, and I was airbrushed out of it as though I had never existed.
That's really funny.
Yeah.
So you saw that photo without you on
that's right.
On yeah. Buses and
that's right.
Posters
that's
all
right.
Over.
And
oh,
I knew
really
there was
funny.
A ghost there. Yeah.
Oh gosh. Well, that's so perfect, because your first book was called Minor Characters.
It's called exactly.
And
exactly.
All about how the women were relegated to the status of minor character in the
yeah.
Beat story. Oh, that's so funny. You know, one of the things that really strikes me of in this book of letters that you and Kerouac wrote to each other is really how well written your letters are. I mean, you were 21, and these are really well written letters with interesting thoughts in them. How do you feel rereading them?
Well, when I heard that these letters still existed, I didn't know how I'd feel when I saw them, but I was surprised by them too, and I. I also realized when I read them how much editing I'd done on them. I didn't want to let Jack know that I was in pain or disappointed. I wanted to be cool. So a lot of these letters reflect my great effort to be cool. I also found that the whole experience of answering Jack was very important for me as a writer. I felt I had to write up to him, and I had to describe things for him. And I could feel my style sort of stretching and changing.
Did you change your style for him?
Yes, I did. I did. And it was and it was good for me.
How did it change?
It got, the sentences got freer and longer, and the breaths got longer. So the rhythms of the sentences changed.
Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts about Jack Kerouac, his writing, or his personality that you'd like to leave us with?
I'll tell you my own theory about Jack. This was something I didn't really come to until years after I wrote my memoir, Minor Characters, and after I'd read the first volume of letters of Jack's selected letters. I'd never really realized before then what bad shape Jack was in at the time that I met him in 57, even before he became famous. I don't think it was the fame that did him in. It had been a cumulative process. My feeling after reading the letters very closely was that something had happened to him after 1951, when he'd had his big breakthrough writing on the road, which he wrote in 3 weeks on a scroll of paper in a kind of nonstop way. And it was a big breakthrough into spontaneous writing, and he wrote all his books the same way after that, in very short, intense periods of time. And I think this discovery, in a certain way, took away the last stability he had in his life. I feel that possibly when he was working in a more conventional way in the town and the city over many years, he always had that work in the center of his life, and that it balanced him. But once he discovered this breakthrough, fast way of writing, he lost that sense of balance. So he'd be on an enormous high, blasting out another book, and then right after it, he'd crash. He'd be in a sort of a terrible valley, full of despair and loneliness and self-hatred and alcohol, until the next time that he could get himself together and write another book in that, you know, breakneck speed. And as he got all these sort of terrible reviews and negative publicity, I think all that that hostility that he encountered got between him and his work. His work was really all he had. It was the only thing he was good at. It was the only thing that made him purely happy. And he lost that source of happiness in his life after the publication of On the Road.
Is there a letter of Jack Kerouac's that is particularly meaningful to you that you'd like to leave us with?
Okay, this is the letter that Jack wrote me from Mexico City on July 28th after the big earthquake. "Don't go to silly Frisco. First place, I have this fine earthquake-proof room for 85 cents a night for both of us. It's an Arabic magic room with tiles on the walls and many big round whorehouse sex orgy mirrors. It's an old 1710 whorehouse, solid with marble floors. We can sleep on the big clean double bed, have our private bath, also with 20-foot ceiling and cloistral bas-relief Mohammedan windows. It's right downtown. You can enjoy city life to the hilt. Then, when we get tired of our Magian and inwardness Sultan's room, we can go off to the country and rent a cottage with flower pots in the window. Your money will last 5 times longer, and in Frisco you wouldn't be seeing anything new and foreign and strange. Take the plane to Mexico City. Bus too long, almost as expensive, too. Then take a cab to my hotel, knock on my door. We'll be gay friends wandering arm in arm in Mexico. Also, we'll do our writing and cash our checks in big American banks and eat hot soup at market stalls and float on rafts of flowers and dance the rumba in mad joints with 10-cent beers. Perhaps you can go to Frisco Cielis after Mexico and complete your educational tour. But I am lonesome for your friendship and love. So try to come down. Lots to talk about. Lots of sleeping and loving, eating and drinking and walking and visiting cathedrals and pyramids. And wait till you drink big water glasses of cold, fresh orange juice every morning for 7 cents and giant T-bone steaks for 85 cents that you can't finish. And I'll show you sites most Americans don't know exist here, and you can write a big book." I think there's real generosity in that. You know, it was a very wholehearted invitation, even though Jack changed his plan after being stricken with the flu. At that moment, anyway, he meant that.
Well, Joyce Johnson, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Joyce Johnson's new book, Door Wide Open, collects the letters that she and Jack Kerouac wrote to each other in 1957 and 58. Here's Kerouac in 1959 reading his poem, Mother, on The Steve Allen Show with Allen at the piano.
"I keep falling in love with my mother. I don't want to hurt her. Of all people to hurt. Every time I see her, she's grown older. But her uniform always amazes me for its Dutch simplicity and the doll she is. The the doll-like way she stands, bow-legged in my dreams, waiting to serve me. And I am only an Apache, smoking hashi in old Kabashi by the lamp.
Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the complete Blue Note Horace Parlan sessions. This is Fresh Air. Jazz pianist Horace Parlan has always had a great feel for the blues and a gospel tinge you can trace to his growing up as the son of a minister. Both strains served him well as a member of Charles Mingus's band in the late 1950s. He played on the bassist's classic albums Blues and Roots and Mingus Ah Um. In the mid-60s, Parlan worked with saxophonist Rassan Roland Kirk. Later, he settled in Copenhagen, where he still lives. Between his stints with Mingus and Kirk, Parlan was signed to Blue Note Records, where he recorded 7 albums as a leader. Those recordings have just been reissued. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
There's something about Pittsburgh. For some reason, they make really good piano players there. Earl Hines, Mary Lou Williams, Errol Garner, Ahmed Jamal, Sonny Clark, and Horace Parlan. Maybe it's something in the water that comes from all those rivers. Or maybe it's foundry smoke. Sometimes, Horace Parlan's keyboard touch and chord voicings give his playing a beautifully dusky quality, as if a soft haze had descended on the piano. In jazz, musicians set their own agendas, free to play to their strengths or sidestep their shortcomings. Pianists with small hands, trumpeters who can't hit high notes, and saxophonists uncomfortable at fast tempos can find ways to compensate so effectively, listeners may not notice a limitation. Horace Parlan was stricken with polio when he was 5 and has only partial use of his right hand. You can hear that he makes up for it, but you have to see him play to appreciate how brilliantly he does it. He'll strike a few simple chords with his right hand, using thumb and 1 or 2 fingers. His amazing left hand plays the usual low-end chords, then leaps up the keys to execute some short melodic line before heading home. That keeps him close to the center of the keyboard, one reason his sound often has that dark, muted air. His technique is strictly homemade, but he uses it to support traditional concepts. Thank you. Morris Parlin with George Tucker on bass and Ray Barreto on congas. Good as Parlin is as a frontman, he really excels in the background, goosing along a horn soloist. He has a drummer's timing and sure instinct for placing accents. His own drummer, on all but one of the sessions he recorded for Blue Note between 1960 and 63, is the overlooked Al Harewood. He's from Brooklyn, but Parlin dug him because he took after the greatest drummer ever to come from Pittsburgh, bebop pioneer Kenny Clarke. When Parlin and Harewood link up, it's almost like having two drummers in the band. Listen to them backing tenor saxophonist Stanley Turrentine, who's also from Pittsburgh. Morris Parlin's ideal tenor saxophonist was the late Booker Ervin. They played together in Charles Mingus's band, on a few of Ervin's records, and on Parlin's last two Blue Note sessions. The pianist's down-home blues and gospel sense was a perfect fit for the saxophonist's Texas tenor shout. They'd met when Ervin spent a few months in Pittsburgh. The sessions they made together are a fitting climax to the new 5-CD box, The Complete Blue Note Horace Parlin Sessions. It's yet another meticulously produced and annotated gem from the mail order house Mosaic Records, who are in Stamford, Connecticut. Hey, it's not like everything good has to come from Pittsburgh.
Kevin Whitehead reviewed the complete Blue Note Horace Parlin sessions on the Mosaic label. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Schirach. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. And Maria Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From BEA, an e-commerce transactions company providing end-to-end solutions for the development and deployment of e-business applications. BEA.com. And from Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of Driving Myself Crazy, The Misadventures of a Novice Golfer by Jessica Maxwell. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, singer-songwriter Shelby Lynn brings her guitar to the studio. Her new CD is a hybrid of soul and country music. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air. What you do?